but Miriam was always tired, whether or not she was taking the pills.
Did Joseph ever have her to a doctor?
No, ma'am. Miriam didn't leave.
She didn't leave the house?
No, ma'am. Never.
Why wasn't Miriam medicated all the time?
Joseph said if God wanted her well, he would make her well.
But sometimes Joseph gave her the medicine?
Yes, ma'am. When Ms. Amber Adler came.
The caseworker?
Yes, ma'am.
Where did Joseph get the pills, if he didn't take her to the doctor?
In the medicine cabinet. In the bathroom.
Yes, Claire, but how did the pills get there, if there was no doctor? You likely need a prescription for such medication. A pharmacy.
I say that I don't know. Joseph would tell me to fetch them, the little plastic baggies. She stops me there.
Plastic baggies?
She asks. And I say yes. And she scribbles something down on that notebook of hers, beside the word Z-E-A-L-O-T, which I've been reading upside down for half an hour now, and still have no idea what it means. He'd pull some pills out and force Miriam to take them. Sometimes he had to pry her mouth open while I popped in the pills, and then we'd wait, for as long as it took for her to swallow. Miriam didn't like the pills. But once or twice a year, Joseph would get her to take the pills for a while, and she'd come out from the room and bathe herself, and we'd open up all the windows, and it would be my job to get that god-awful Miriam smell out of the home, before Ms. Amber Adler, in her junker car with the too big Nike bag, arrived. He'd get out his toolbox and start fixing things around the house, paint over stains that had cropped up here and there around the home. Only when Amber Adler came to call did the dead light bulbs get replaced and squeaky hinges get oiled. Joseph always had a new dress for me as opposed to the small musty duds he dropped off in my room in a large white garbage bag, like he'd picked it up at the end of someone's drive on garbage day. Once he even brought me a pair of shoes, patent leather, which were far too big, but he told me to put them on nonetheless so Ms. Adler could see. The caseworker brought letters from Paul and Lily Zeger. She said she could give the Zegers my new address. But after Joseph tore the photos of Mama into shreds, I said no thanks, that was all right. She could just bring the letters along when she came. Lily Zeger wrote beautiful letters about my baby sister, Rose, Lily, with the name Lily always in parentheses, just in case I didn't know who it was she was talking about. She said that Rose, Lily, was growing bigger and bigger every day, and that from the photos she's seen, Rose, Lily, was looking more and more like our mama, who was a stunning, sensational, dazzling woman, as if the many compliments might negate the fact that she's dead. She said that Rose, Lily, was learning her ABCs and how to count to 10, and that she could sing as well as the yellow warbler, which, according to Big Lily, surrounded their Colorado home. And there were photos attached of a charming little A-frame home snuggled right in the middle of the woods, with mountains in the background, and a tiny dog, like a cocker spaniel or something, running around the legs of my Lily. And there she is, little Lily, with the ringlets of black hair, black like Mama's, that had grown longer and were clipped back in ladybug barrettes. And she was wearing a bright yellow sundress with ruffles, and a bow as big as her head. And she was smiling. Paul Zeger stood on a balcony in a shirt and striped tie, looking down at little Lily. And I imagined Big Lily took the picture, but she was nowhere to be seen. Even the dog looked happy. The letter said how Rose, Lily, was taking a ballet class and loved to practice her pirouettes and relevés for Paul and Lily, and how she absolutely adored her cerise leotard and tutu, and that in the fall Rose, Lily, would begin preschool at the Montessori school in town. "What's a Montessori school?" I asked Ms. Amber Adler, and she looked at me and smiled and said, "It's a good thing," while patting my hand. I asked her why Paul and Lily Zeger didn't have any kids of their own. Why'd they need my Lily? And she said sometimes things just worked out that way. One or the other of them couldn't have kids. It just wasn't meant to be. And I thought of Joseph saying that if God wanted Miriam to be well, he'd make her well. And I thought that if God wanted Paul and Lily to have kids, he would have given them kids. Kids of their own. Not my Lily. Lily was mine. I thought a lot about that A-frame house where Lily now lived. I thought about the tall, tall trees, and the mountains and the dog. I thought how I'd like to go there, to that house in the woods, and see my Lily again. I wondered if I ever could. Big Lily said that I could write a letter back to Rose. Lily, if I wanted to, and she'd read it to her. So I did. I told her about the tulips outside our home, of which there were none, and what I was learning in school. There was no school. The only reading that went on in our home was from the Bible. The only writing was when Joseph made me copy word for word from Deuteronomy or Leviticus. The school reports that Joseph handed over to the caseworker, those which showed my poor grades in school, were forged, photocopies of Matthew's or Isaac's report cards that had been altered with my name, with failing grades in math and science, with teacher comments that detailed my disregard for authority figures, my misbehavior. "Don't you like school?" the caseworker would ask. "I like it just fine," I'd say. "What's your favorite subject?" she wanted to know. I didn't know much about subjects, so I said math. "But Claire, it says here that you are failing your math class." And I would shrug and say that it was hard, and she'd remind me, as she often did, how lucky I was to have Joseph and Miriam in my life, how other foster families would not be so flexible and understanding. "You need to try harder," she would say to me. And to Joseph and Miriam, she'd suggest a tutor. In my letters, I told little Lily about living in the big city, Omaha, and I described the buildings, though I'd never once seen the buildings. I had an inkling they were there. This Omaha place was much different than Ogallala. I could tell that from the smells, the sounds, the kids on the other side of the window. Mama used to talk about Omaha when we were kids, about the people and buildings, museums and zoos. In my letters, I told Lily about my brothers, who I barely knew. I told her about the friends I'd made in school. There were no friends. And how my teachers were an absolute delight. There were no teachers. In Big Lily's responses, she told me of Rose's, Lily's, fourth birthday present, a new bike, mint green and pink, with training wheels and tassels, a white wicker basket and a banana seat. There were pictures. Little Lily in a helmet on the bike with Paul Zeger pushing from behind. The little cocker spaniel running after them. She told me of an upcoming vacation to California to see the beach. She said that this would be Rose's, Lily's, first time ever seeing the ocean, and wondered, had I seen the ocean before? They'd picked out a new swimsuit and cover-up for the occasion. The next time the caseworker arrived, there were drawings from Lily herself, of the ocean, and fish, and blobs in the sand that may or may not have been seashells, and a bright yellow sun with rays that swept off the page. On the back, Big Lily had written in her perfect penmanship, "Rose, Lily, 4 years old." They weren't bad people. In time, I understood that. But knowing it in my mind and in my heart were two very different things.
Heidi. In the morning, Zoe, reluctantly, offers up another outfit for Willow to wear. This time, black leggings that are far too short for Zoe's own legs, and much shorter on Willow's, and a sweatshirt with paint splatters on the front, an art smock from the previous school year. "Zoe, please," I say. "This one is a mess." "Fine," she gripes, yanking an extra school cardigan from its hanger and thrusting it into Willow's hands. "Here." The girls eat breakfast, heaping bowls of frosted flakes. And then Zoe disappears to bathe and dress. Ruby, on my lap, is sound asleep, finally. Having been up and agitated since before 5 a.m., awoken in the early hours of dawn by a fever. Because unhappy babies need to be rocked when they're upset, and we, of course, had no rocking chair, I pressed her to my chest and moved back and forth in a seesaw motion until she finally began to settle, until the muscles in my back began to burn. But I didn't mind. There was something gratifying about it, something so satisfying when Ruby finally began to grow tired and slowly closed her eyes. It was then that I lowered my body onto the leather armchair, completely immersed in the way Ruby's eyelids fluttered when asleep, the way her tiny fingers folded over my thumb, refusing to let go, completely immersed in the tiny toes of her left foot, where she'd wiggled the lacy sock right off and onto the hardwood floor, completely immersed in the filaments of hair that emerged from her head, in the softness of her scalp, the blanched skin. So immersed, in fact, that I lost track of time completely, forgot about the need to walk Zoe to school, the need to go to work. Before I know it, Zoe stands, hovering before the front door, her backpack thrown over a shoulder. She has her coat on, partway zipped, and an umbrella dangling by its cord from her wrist. "You ready to go?" she asks, and I peer down at my own attire, at the robe and a pair of sheepskin slippers still warming my feet. "Mom!" Zoe snaps this time, having just discovered that I'm still in my pajamas. I make no effort to move, fearful of waking Ruby from her nap. I feel my mouth open, a shh emerging so that Zoe's voice will not rouse the baby from sleep. Zoe, in a huff, frowns, her eyes bouncing between a clock on the wall and me, her body antsy. Her posture sags, her shoulders slump forward, the small of her back arched. Her backpack falls from her shoulder and into the crook of an elbow before she thrusts it back up and sighs. I whisper, "I'm not going to work," just like that. "You'll have to walk yourself to school," I say, expecting her to leap up and down with joy, for this is the one thing she's been begging for years to do. To walk herself to school alone, as her best friend Taylor is allowed to do. But instead of joy, her mouth drops open, and she says to me with disdain, "What do you mean you're not going to work? You always go to work." A fact altogether true. For the times that I've called in sick for work, even when a young Zoe was home sick with the flu, were few and far between. Oftentimes it was Chris I begged to stay home from work, or when he was unable, his parents beckoned from their west suburban home, or, in moments of desperation, Graham. But the weight of Ruby, sound asleep on my lap, reminds me that I cannot leave. My finger, nestled in the flabby clutches of her hand, assures me I cannot go. "I have plenty of vacation time accrued," I say in a hushed tone, and then remind Zoe about the paper lunch sack awaiting her on the kitchen table, with ants on a log inside, a recent fad now that she's watching her weight. I wonder if I watched my weight when I was 12. Doubtful, imagining that that too came later, 16 or 17 perhaps. She gropes for the bag, the paper crinkling loudly in the palm of her hand. Ruby stirs on my lap and opens her eyes ever so slightly, before stretching her arms high above her head and falling back to sleep. "Have a good day," I whisper to Zoe before she leaves, and she responds with a noncommittal, "Whatever," before disappearing into the hall, leaving the door wide open so that I have to ask Willow to close it, please. I'm hopeful that Zoe will remember to keep Willow a secret, that she will remember that she's not to mention our guest to her classmates at school, to her teachers. Harboring a runaway for more than 48 hours is deemed a crime. A Class A misdemeanor punishable by up to a year in prison. Years of probation, a hefty fine. But knowing this and believing this are two different things. I find it hard to believe that I could ever be caught, or that the police would enforce such a penalty when what I am doing is helping this girl. I wonder where the police were when someone thwacked Willow so hard that the ochre bruise formed on her head, or when some lecherous man laid himself atop her body. Was she alone when Ruby was born? Tucked down some dark alley at night, beneath rusting fire escapes and dripping air conditioner units, beside rat-infested dumpsters, leaned up against some brick wall covered with graffiti, the sounds of the city invalidating the sounds of her screams. There is an image I carry in my mind. That image of Willow down a darkened alley, giving birth to a baby. As I sit on the leather armchair with Ruby sound asleep in my lap, Willow perched by the window in silence, watching pedestrians come and go, I count back 4 months in my head. March, February, January, December. Ruby would have been born sometime in December. Add to my image, dirty slushy snow, the biting cold, freezing the blood as it oozed from the birthing canal. In my image, Willow is replaced by Zoe, a daughter, someone's daughter. Where is her mother? Why wasn't her mother there to protect her from this ghastly fate? I find myself staring at Willow, at the hair that hangs in her face, covering eyes that are slowly catching up on sleep, skin that is beginning to soften from the cold spring air. She isn't a tall girl, per se, about 6 inches shorter than me, so that I can see the top of her head, the place where tawny roots grow in from her scalp, uninterrupted by the imitation red. I reach out and, without thinking, lay my fingers briefly on her infected earring holes, the skin red and crusty, the lobe beginning to bulge. She withdraws quickly from my touch, blanching as if I'd slapped her with the back of a hand. "I'm so sorry," I gasp, withdrawing my hand. "I'm sorry, I didn't..." My voice wanders off. I gather myself and try again with, "We should take a look at that. A little Neosporin might do the trick." Knowing that between Ruby's ever-present fever and this, we may need to see a doctor before long. After some time, Willow asks apprehensively to borrow my copy of Anne of Green Gables, and I, of course, say yes, watching as she retires to Chris's office to read. I watch as she carries the worn copy pressed close to her heart, and I wonder what significance the novel holds for her, its narrative committed to her memory like biblical text. I could ask her. I could ask Willow about the book. But I imagine her curling into a ball like an armadillo, or a woodlouse, at my interrogation, and hiding inside her armor shell. I slip from the leather armchair and settle down at the kitchen table with my laptop and a mug of coffee, Ruby swaddled in a blanket and set on my lap. I pull up a search engine and type into the box, "Child abuse." I come to learn that over 1,000 children die each year in our country due to abuse or neglect on the part of their caregivers. Over 3 million child abuse reports are made each year by teachers, local authorities, friends of the family, neighbors, or the ubiquitous anonymous calls that Child Services receives. Child abuse can result in physical injuries, bruises and bone fractures, the need for sutures, damage to the spinal cord, the brain, the neck, second and third degree burns, and so on and so forth. Emotionally, the abuse is damaging as well, leading to depression in even the youngest of victims, withdrawal, antisocial behavior, eating disorders, attempts at suicide, illicit sexual activities, And, as my eyes drift over the words, my mind forms an image of Willow, pregnant with a fetal ruby growing inside her womb. Teenage pregnancy. Victims of abuse are more likely to use alcohol and drugs, to participate in criminal activity, to fare poorer in school than the comparable child who has not been abused. Who is the father of that child? I wonder as I get a second cup of coffee, dribbling creamer along the countertop as I do. A lover? A boyfriend? A sadistic schoolteacher? One who took advantage of his position of power to seduce a student, or maybe tempt her with an easygoing smile and an approachable manner? Or perhaps her own father? A neighbor? A sibling? And then I remember Matthew, her brother Matthew, who reads Anne of Green Gables. Is Matthew the father of that child? The sound of Willow's feet pitches me across the room, and I slam the laptop shut so she doesn't see the words scattered at random across the screen, assault and molest and sexual abuse. I stand, breathing hard, with hands on hips and an overdone impression of relaxation, as she asks permission to turn on the TV, and I say, yes, of course, so long as she keeps the volume low. I watch as she settles on the leather chair and turns the TV to Sesame Street, the kind of kids show Zoe hasn't watched since she was 4 or 5. I find it odd, odd indeed. I'm not quite sure what to make of it. But then, somehow or other, my concern for Willow starts to wane, and I find my attention focusing on Ruby instead. The online child abuse investigation morphing into a shopping expedition for rocking chairs. Thinking less about that ochre bruise atop Willow's head, and more about a baby's need to rock. About nestling before the big bay window with Ruby in my arms, and watching for hours as raindrops fall from the sky.
Chris. One night turns into two. Then two nights turn into three. I'm not quite sure how it happens. I come home from work, ready and motivated to tell Heidi it is time for her to leave. I make a plan in my head, how I will give the girl $50, no, $100, enough for her to make do for a while. I'll map out the homeless shelters within the city limits, so Heidi can see I'm trying. I'll get her there myself, in a cab, make sure she gets inside the shelter. Make sure they accept babies. I go through the words in my head, what I will say to Heidi. I jot down a numbered list in my notes on the way home from work, the writing like chicken scratches from the motion of the train. As I walk from the Fullerton station, I polish the words in my head. "We'll be generous," I say. "Give her plenty. Make sure she has everything she needs." I'll gaze into Heidi's bewitching brown eyes and make her understand that this is the way it has to be. I'll be tactful and delicate. I'll use Zoe as justification. Zoe might think you care more about Willow's needs than you do her own. Then she'll see. If I pit Zoe against Willow, Heidi will see. But as they say, the best laid plans of mice and men often go astray. I'm not a block from home when thunder explodes in an otherwise quiet night, when the rain, cold, thick rain, begins to drop from the sky. A band of clouds rolls in across the city like a cinder block wall. I break into a jog, aware that the temperature has begun to plunge as well, a 50-degree day morphing into a 30-degree night. What kind of monster would I be if I sent this girl off into a monsoon? That's what Heidi would say, I think, as I climb the steps to our home, shaking the rainwater off my coat and hair. I come in to find the girl on the couch, the evil black cat on her lap. Heidi and Zoe are at the kitchen table, discussing probability. Probability of simple events. Probability of overlapping events. What is the probability of another rainy night during the wettest April on record? Heidi has not gone to work for 2 days now in a row. 2 days. It was me who, days ago, forbid her from leaving that girl alone in our home, as my eyes roved from personal files to jewelry boxes to various electronics, pointing out all the things she was liable to steal. Heidi had eyed the 40-inch TV perched on the wall, imagined the girl walking down Fullerton with that in her hands, and asked, "Really, Chris?" pointing out what a pessimist I could be. And I had said, "Don't be so naive." But she has used this to her advantage, as an excuse to stay home from work rather than kick the girl to the curb as I had hoped she'd do. She said she couldn't leave Willow alone for fear she'd steal something, the 40-inch TV or her father's wedding ring. The baby is on the floor, sound asleep. There are weathermen on the TV talking about the string of storms set to pass through the city during the night, the type of storm system, they say, that produces tornadoes, causing widespread damage. If you live in the towns of Dixon or Eldena, take cover now. The storms are headed our way from central Illinois, from Iowa. Red and orange blips on the Doppler radar that the weathermen flash on the TV screen. Heidi asks, "Raining again?" as I hang my saturated coat on a hook by the door and slip out of my shoes, her voice elevated over the thumping sound of the rain. I say that it is. "Just started up," I say. "Getting colder, too," as a clap of thunder rattles through the sky, shaking the building and everyone inside.
"Going to be a doozy,"
says Heidi, about the storm, her eyes set on Willow across the room, stroking the cat with the palm of her hand, staring vacantly out the blackened windows. Lightning brightens the sky, and she jumps, withdrawing into the sofa cushions as if she's trying to hide. I kiss Heidi and Zoe on the cheek, and take my leftover dinner, the plate on the countertop, tucked beneath a paper towel to the microwave to reheat it. I peek under the paper towel and see pork chops. Maybe this girl isn't so bad after all. The cold air disseminates through our home, through the breaches in the drafty windows. Outside, the wind howls and the trees sway. Heidi rises from her chair, crosses the room, and flips on the gas fireplace to warm the space. It's then that I see out of the corner of my eye a look of dread that overtakes Willow as she springs to her feet, the black cat plummeting to the ground. Her eyes are fastened to that fireplace, the fire glowing orange among the artificial embers. The flames, how they dance dramatically behind the mesh screen, coaxing the cats, enticing them, the both of them, to the warmth of the fire. They sprawl out beside it, oblivious to Willow's distress.
"Fire,"
she says, her voice shaky and subdued. She's pointing at the black fireplace with its black louvers on the white wall, surrounded by built-in nooks and crannies that house Heidi's knick-knacks, her snow globes and vases, a collection of vintage jars.
"Fire,"
she says again, and I'm reminded of cavemen discovering fire for the very first time. Her eyes are glassy, like marbles. Her face has gone white. It's a knee-jerk reflex when Heidi flips the fireplace off. The flames disappear. The gas logs return to their hand-painted, blackened state.
"Willow?"
she says, her voice as wobbly as Willow's when she said fire. But there's a calmness in Heidi's voice that the girl doesn't possess. A hint of reason. The rest of us in the room were silent. The cats stare at the fireplace, growing cold.
"It's okay, Willow,"
Heidi declares.
"It's just a fireplace. It's safe. Perfectly safe."
And her eyes stray to mine, begging to know what in the hell just happened. My shoulders rise and fall as Willow settles back down on the sofa, shaking the image of that fire from her mind. I eat my dinner and excuse myself, into the bedroom to make a call. A work call, I say, so that I won't be interrupted. But it isn't a work call at all. I've been doing my own research on Willow Greer, hitting one dead end after the next. I've widened my search to more than a Google search. In every spare second of downtime, I'm on my laptop searching for the girl. I've moved on to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and to searching active Amber Alerts, I've even signed up to receive Amber Alerts via email, and am now being notified every time some alienated spouse tries to run off with his or her own kid. But so far, nothing. Nada. After discovering the Twitter account @LostWithoutYou linked to a W. Greer, I spent more time than I'd ever admit reading the girl's bleak tweets, the threats of self-destruction, staring at photos she's posted online, her arms scratched to smithereens, or so she claimed, by the sharp edge of a razor blade. Cutting. There were responses from all sorts of other hooligans, their photos of self-inflicted wounds trying to one-up each other. Jagged, red words chiseled into the skin. Fat, and pain, and whore. There were challenges made in response to @LostWithoutYou's suicidal threats. Do it, and I double dog dare you. There were more photos, too, of her various tattoos. Assorted occult symbols on a shoulder and leg. Some sort of butterfly with black and yellow wings spread across the palm of a hand. A close-up of her face, and there, hidden behind gangly red hair, a pair of cross earrings much like the ones our Willow wore. A pair of angel's wings. Could it be a coincidence? I stare long and hard at those earrings and think, probably not. Could our Willow Greer be the same girl, with a profile photo that is not her own? Maybe. I browse others' profile photos. A dog, a cat, Marilyn Monroe. There's no law that says your photo has to be your photo. On a whim, I set up my own Twitter account, @MoneyMan3. I upload a photo I find online. Some male model with blue eyes and bushy blonde hair, shirtless, flaunting six-pack abs. A man can dream. I send a tweet to @LostWithoutYou. Does it hurt? I ask, about the parallel red lines lacerated into the skin. And then I make my phone call. I have an old college friend who does some PI work around town, mostly in the realm of cheating spouses. Martin Miller. He's got the best stories to tell. Stories of high-class women winding up in seedy hotels. His website claims to find lost loves, college sweethearts, teenage runaways. Maybe he can help. When Martin answers, I tell him about our little situation. He vows to be utterly discreet. The last thing I need is Heidi to know I've hired a PI, or for this information to wind up in the wrong hands. If he turns the information over to the authorities, no, I think. I scan the website again. Utmost discretion, it says. And besides, I know this guy. How is it, then, that I know about the high-class women and the seedy hotels? No, I think, pushing that thought from my mind. I hear him laugh about it at some dive bar out in Logan Square. It was about 5 years ago, maybe more. We were drunk. I know this guy. Later that night, as I lie in the magenta sleeping bag on the floor, I think of that girl, the look on her face when she saw that fire. How does a teenage girl come to be terrified of lightning? Of fire? Zoe hasn't been scared of those things since she was 8. I almost feel sorry for her. Almost. But then again, being solicitous isn't really my thing. It's Heidi's.
Heidi. Willow settles into our home slowly, like the natural weathering of rocks over time, breaking into smaller and smaller pieces. Pebbles. She reveals little about herself, nearly nothing, and yet that alone becomes commonplace. I stop asking questions, stop trying to solicit information about her, her family, her past, knowing the responses will be sparse and incomplete. There is a brother named Matthew. That much I know. In what little time she's been with us, each of us takes to her in our own way. Chris in a synthetic way, his empathy manufactured and strained. He tolerates her, though each day I'm barraged with questions about how many more days she will stay. One night, he asks. too? Though I tell him I don't know. He shakes his head at me and says, Heidi, this is really getting out of hand. And I make him see that for all the days she's been with us, she hasn't done a single harmful thing. Our lives are still intact. Electronics have yet to be swiped from the house while we sleep. She's harmless, I tell him, but he is not so sure. And yet, from time to time my mind retreats to the blood on the undershirt, hurled down the garbage chute and now taking up residence in some landfill in Dalton. I wonder whether or not it truly belonged to Willow as she said it did, an effect of the cold spring air, or if perhaps... But I stop myself, refusing to consider other options. I see those blood splatters at the oddest of times, when taking a shower, when making dinner. Quiet moments when my thoughts wander away from me, away from the everyday busyness to blood. I find myself thinking about the baby, about Ruby, all the time, when I'm not thinking about the blood. Holding Ruby and listening to her wail, it reminds me of all the imaginary children I once longed to have, the ones I was supposed to have. I find myself dreaming night after night about babies. Living babies, dead babies, cherubic babies, cherubs with their angelic wings. I dream of Juliet. I dream of embryos and fetuses and baby bottles and baby shoes. I dream of giving birth to babies all night long. I dream of blood. Blood on the undershirt. Blood oozing from between my legs, red and thick, coagulating inside my panties, panties that were once a brilliant white, like the undershirt. I wake in a panic, sweating, while Chris and Zoe never stir. Zoe takes to Willow, as she does most everything in life, with hostility. There are days she eyeballs the girl from across the room with something akin to loathing in her eyes. She grumbles about sharing her clothes with the girl, or not being allowed to watch some kitschy show on the TV. She refuses to hold Ruby for a split second when Willow is in the restroom and I'm otherwise occupied. She refuses to give the baby a bottle, and when she cries, as she often does, pathetic, persistent crying, Zoe rolls her eyes and walks out of the room. I take to making 3-course meals, grateful that someone is there to lick her plate clean. I make salads and soups, lasagna and chicken tetrazzini, watching as Willow devours the meals one by one, always grateful for seconds, while Zoe stares desolately at the food, asking questions like, "What even is this?" and, "I thought we were vegetarians." In that way, only a preteen can, the falsetto of her voice whiny and shrill. I watch Zoe pick at the lettuce leaves of her salad like a rabbit, thankful that Willow across the table is completely ravenous and will not let good food go to waste. In the afternoon, when Zoe is at school and I am home from work, I find myself staring at Willow, at Ruby, at the way Willow handles Ruby, heavy-handed and inept, until I lift the baby from her arms and say, "Here, let me," sure to tack on, "You could use a break," so as not to insult her. I don't know what she makes of it, of the way I remove the baby from her arms. I'm not entirely sure I care. I press my lips to the baby's forehead and whisper, "There now, sweet girl," as I bobble her up and down ever so gently, trying hard to make her smile. I settle into the new rocking chair, purchased online and delivered this morning via FedEx, a delivery which Chris had yet to see. I paid extra, nearly $100 for expedited delivery, though this detail I won't mention to Chris. I press my back into the lumbar support and the baby and I begin to sway. I hum Patsy Cline lullabies under my breath, songs that my mother one day hummed to me, which seems to get Willow's attention, though she tries hard to pretend she doesn't care. I watch the girl out of the corner of my eye, wondering ominously if or when she will want the baby returned to her custody, when she will tire of staring at Muppets on the TV screen, and wish to retreat to the office with Anne of Green Gables and the baby. My arms tighten around the baby automatically, like a seatbelt in an auto collision. Willow has been with me for over 48 hours now, and all I know is her first name, if, as Chris points out, that is her real name, and that she has a brother, Matthew. She doesn't offer a thing about herself, and I don't ask, certain that any interrogation will scare her away, and she will leave, taking with her the baby. My mind makes up for the lack of information, inventing all sorts of narratives that brought her and the baby into our lives. Tales of spring tornadoes sweeping through the Midwest and carrying her from her home. Tales of her running away to escape the huntsman, who's to return to the castle with her heart. From time to time she starts to say something, only ever a single word, or sometimes just a syllable or two that sneak between her lips. But then she stops herself suddenly and claims oblivion. She's grave. She doesn't smile. She might as well be an elderly lady, what with all the baggage she carries in her eyes and meek demeanor. She's quiet, virtually silent, sitting on that sofa, staring blindly at the TV. She watches cartoons, mostly, almost always Sesame Street, staring at the TV longingly, until Chris or Zoe or I break her reverie. She eats quickly, passionately, as if she's been deprived of a home-cooked meal for the greater part of her life. And at night, as I hover in the hallway after we've parted ways and she's drifted into her room, I wait for the door to lock, as it does every night, for that latch to assure her that no one will be slinking into her room, prowling in the shadows while she sleeps. I hear her sometimes in the middle of the night. I hear her subconscious murmur a single phrase while she sleeps. Come with me. Over and over again. Come with me. Her voice escalating at times until the words verge on desolate, a do-or-die attempt at persuasion. Come with me. Come with me. But who is she talking to, I wonder? And where does she want them to go? She cleans up after herself, bringing her dishes to the sink, where she washes and dries them by hand, though I beg her not to. Please, I say, leave them. I'm just going to load the dishwasher. But she does anyway, as if she feels she has to, double and triple checking sometimes for remnants of food encrusted to the plates or left behind in the tines of the forks. As if such a simple oversight would elicit admonishment. And I picture her. Picture Willow, bent over a kitchen chair, receiving the prescribed number of lashings for leaving food behind on a plate. And then a knock on the head to deliver the ochre bruise. The baby and I sway in the rocking chair. Willow sitting on the sofa in silence. Ruby wiggles in my arms, her mouth plugged with a pacifier, unable to cry, though she wants nothing less than to belt out a blood-curdling scream. I see the agitation in her eyes, eyes that are shellacked thanks to yet another fever. I moisten a washcloth and press it to her head, and continue to hum lullabies in the hopes of pacification. It's then that Willow turns to me, her voice in that moment of near silence startling me, wanting to know in her generally timid, generally submissive tone, "How come you didn't have any more babies, if you like them so much?" I feel the air in the room become too thin to breathe. I could lie. I could evade the question altogether. No one has ever asked me such a question. Not even Zoe. I think back some 11 years. The beginning of the end. Or so it felt at the time. Zoe was less than a year old, a cuddlesome creature when she wasn't in the midst of a colicky rage, the kind that brought neighbors to our door to see what they could do to silence the child so they could sleep. She was just 5, maybe 6 months old when I discovered I was carrying another child, that I was carrying Juliet. We weren't trying to conceive, Chris and I, but we weren't taking precautions not to, either. I was absolutely elated when I found out I was pregnant, certain that this was just the beginning of that vast family I longed to have. How Chris felt about it, I wasn't entirely sure. "It's soon," he said the day I told him, standing before the bathroom door with a positive pregnancy test in my hand. "We already have a baby." But then he smiled, and there was a hug. And there were conversations over those fleeting few weeks. What we would name the baby, and whether or not the baby and Zoe could share a room. What I noticed first was blood. A watery discharge that turned crimson with time. And then there was the pain. I was certain I was having a miscarriage when I caught sight of the blood there in my panties. But the doctor assured me the baby was just fine. A biopsy confirmed stage 1B cervical cancer. The doctor recommended a radical hysterectomy, which meant first ridding my womb of Juliet. "It's a simple procedure," the doctor assured Chris and me, and I read online how they would dilate my cervix and then scrape the contents of my uterus clean, and I imagined Juliet as the pulp of a pumpkin, being scooped out with a spoon. "No," I said, "and absolutely not." But somehow or other, Chris convinced me that an abortion was something we needed to do. "If it was later in the pregnancy," he'd said, mimicking the doctor's words, "and if the cancer wasn't so advanced." And then, "I can't raise Zoe alone," he'd said, "if something happens to you." And I thought of Chris and Zoe all alone, and myself dead in a tomb. Had the cancer not been so advanced, we could have delayed treatment until after the birth. But such was not the case. As it was the baby or me. And I chose me, a decision that would haunt me for the rest of my life. The doctor and Chris corrected me every time I said baby. They called her a fetus instead. "There's no way to know," the doctor had said before they discarded my Juliet as medical waste, "whether or not she's a girl. Reproductive organs don't develop until the 3rd month of pregnancy." And yet, I knew. I stared at the pamphlets the doctor handed me in the office, angry that I had gotten so busy with work and Zoe that I'd fallen behind on regular pap tests, that I'd missed my own 6-week postpartum checkup because I couldn't be bothered. "Cervical cancer," the pamphlets said, "could be detected early with routine pap smears," something I'd failed to have. I was angry that I fit none of the risk factors. I didn't smoke, I wasn't immunosuppressed, and as far as I knew, I hadn't come in contact with HPV. I was the exception. The rarity, the 1 in 1,000,000. This wasn't supposed to happen to me. The doctor chopped out my uterus, and while he was down there, he thought, "What the heck? Cut out my fallopian tubes and ovaries as well. The cervix, part of the vagina, the lymph nodes, too." It took nearly 6 weeks to recover, physically. Emotionally, I never would. What I hadn't expected were the hot flashes that flared up out of the blue, the sudden intense heat waves that washed over my body, the rosacea that took over my skin, my heart beating out of control, the need to drop into a chair and catch my breath as I saw older women, often do, the night sweats that kept me up when I wasn't being kept awake by my young child, the insomnia that gave way to moodiness and irritability, the ember flashes that lingered for years after the hot flashes were through. I was going through menopause. I wasn't yet 30 years old. I noticed that my metabolism, too, had slowed, inches accumulating on my once slim waist. Chris claimed not to notice, but I most certainly did. I noticed when pants went from a size 4 to a size 8, when I began to eye women like Cassidy Knudsen, young, slim, and fertile, like some green-eyed monster. Green with envy. They were bountiful, fruitful, productive. And I was barren, dry and desolate, unable to support growth. Growing older all the time, much too fast for a woman my age. "Think of it this way," Chris had said in an effort to appease me. "You'll never have to worry about getting your period again." Uttering that word period in a squeamish way, and yet I imagined it longingly. What I wouldn't give to go to the drugstore and buy a box of tampons, to experience that monthly flow, a reminder of the life inside me, the anticipation of a life inside me. But that life was gone. "Cancer," I whisper, forcing that ugly word out. "Cervical cancer. They had to remove my uterus." I wonder if Willow understands what any of this means. She sits on the sofa, staring at that TV. Bert and Ernie pass through, with their beloved rubber ducky. Ernie begins to sing. Her voice is subdued, like a pale shade of pink, pastel, subtle.
"But you wanted more babies?" she asks.
"Yes," I say, feeling vanquished by that hole in my heart, the one where Juliet used to reside.
"Very much so."
Chris said we'd adopt more children. "All the orphans in the world," he said. "Every last one of them." But after giving birth to my own flesh and blood, I didn't want those children. I wanted my own. Adoption was no longer a viable option. I couldn't imagine raising a child who was not my own. I felt cheated, swindled. My heart was closed for business.
"You make a good mama," Willow says.
And then her eyes drift to the lightning outside. The rumble of thunder that encroaches into the city like a cancerous growth. And she says, more to herself than to me,
"My mama was good."
"Tell me about your mama," I breathe. And she does, waveringly. She tells me about her dark hair. She tells me about her blue eyes. She tells me her name, Holly. She tells me that she did hair, in the bathroom, cuts and perms and updos. She tells me she liked to cook, but she wasn't too good at it. She'd burn things, or else they'd be undercooked, the inside of her chicken still pink when she bit into it. She liked to listen to music, country music, Dolly Parton, Loretta Lynn, Patsy Cline. She isn't looking at me when she speaks, but rather at the Muppets on the TV screen, Big Bird and Elmo, Cookie Monster. She stares at their bright colors, their eccentricities.
"Where is your mother?"
I ask, but she ignores this. I tell her about my father, and as I do so, a hand instinctively goes to his wedding band, dangling from the gold chain around my neck. At the mention of Patsy Cline, her voice returns to me, running like a soundtrack through my mind. Patsy Cline's death left such an impression on my own mother during her teenage years that songs like Crazy and Walkin' After Midnight became part of my childhood, as did the images of my mother and father twirling around the copper-brown living room carpeting, hand in hand, cheek to cheek, dancing.
"That ring,"
Willow asks, pointing at it.
"That's his?"
And I say that, yes, it is. And then, for whatever reason, I tell her about the wild goose chase Chris and I went on to find a gold chain that matched. It had to be a perfect match. Close wasn't good enough for me. Wasn't good enough for my father. Chris special ordered the chain, a purchase that cost him over $1,000. We could buy a TV for that kind of money. A new computer, he said. Put it toward a vacation. But I said no. I had to have the chain. This ring, I had said to Chris that day, standing on Wabash in the midst of Jeweler's Row, tears dousing my tired, insomniac eyes, eyes which hadn't slept since before my father died, is all that remains of my father. The rest is gone. I don't tell Willow how I fell into a state of deep depression after my father died, a quiet, placid death following an altercation with lung cancer. Small cell lung cancer, that is. The kind that had metastasized to the brain, the liver, and the bone before he ever knew it was there. I don't tell her how he refused treatment. He continued to smoke. Marlboro Reds. Half a pack a day. I don't tell her how my mother buried him with a carton of Marlboro Reds and a neon green lighter for use in the afterlife. I do tell Willow about the glorious fall day that we buried my father in the cemetery beside the church, beneath a sugar maple that had turned tangerine overnight. I tell her how the pallbearers carried that casket out of the church, up a spongy hill into the cemetery. It had rained the night before and the ground was wet. I tell her how my mother and I followed behind, how I held on to my mother so she wouldn't slip. But more so, because I couldn't let go. Because I was already burying one parent, and I couldn't bear to lose another. I tell her how we watched them lower him in, and then we laid roses on top of the casket. Lavender roses, because that's what my mother carried when they were wed. It's then that she looks at me with those tired cornflower eyes and says, in that way one says they hate terrorists or Nazis, as if they are truly an abomination to all mankind, and not just how people say they hate the smell of burnt popcorn or hate the sight of overweight women in midriffs. I hate roses. And I try hard not to take offense, reminding myself, to each his own. And yet it seems a terribly odd response to my confession. And then she says, after a period of silence so long that I'm all but certain our revelations are through, my mama is dead. And that word, dead, sneaks out noncommittally, as though she isn't quite sure whether or not she's dead, or what that word really means to her. Like someone told her that her mother was dead, like one says, a drop in the bucket or a piece of cake. An idiom. The kind of word or phrase that makes no logical sense. My mama is dead. How? I ask. But she won't say. Instead, she curls into a ball, hiding inside her armadillo shell. Her eyes remain locked on the TV, though they've grown glassy and inexpressive, as if she's made a hard-line decision not to cry. I ask again, Willow? But she ignores this completely, as if unaware of my voice, unaware of the way my eyes are cemented to her, cemented to the wayward hair and the lips caked in chapstick, desperate for an answer to my question. An answer that doesn't come. And then, in time, when she tires of my staring, perhaps, she lifts the baby from my arms and leaves the room.
Chris. I'm taking the steps two at a time down to the L platform when the call comes in on my cell. Henry. I stop mid-stride and retreat to street level, leaning against the fence that encloses the steps leading underground. The street is full of cars and pedestrians heading home from work. It's not quite dark outside, one of those rare work days I leave the office on time. A bus is holding up traffic on the street. Some suburbanite or out-of-towner tries to bypass it, nearly killing a half-dozen pedestrians at the same time. Brakes squeal. A horn blares. Someone yells,